All right. Well, thank you very much to the Philadelphia Society for inviting the younger generation. I would like to speak on as a member of the younger generation, I'd like to speak on a topic that's within my living memory, so the Obama presidency. In an interview with Oprah Winfrey, this is where the younger generation gets most of its news. In an interview with Oprah Winfrey near the conclusion of his first year in office, President Obama graded his performance a solid B+. That score, argued Obama, would inevitably improve once Congress passed the health care bill. Well, affordable health care for all Americans finally made its way through Congress and was signed by the president, but the legislation has not been accompanied with the kind of enthusiasm or grade inflation that the president hoped for. During both the primaries and the presidential contests, Obama often spoke of his disdain for ideologies and his preference for results-oriented pragmatism. Yet his message of pragmatism was commonly couched in terms of a visionary rhetoric that would reportedly transport his supporters into a near frenzy. Now, I think by his pragmatic standards, Obama's legislative leadership actually deserves some decent marks. He did, in fact, convince Democrats in Congress to compromise with some of their most virulent opposition and to pass a bill that did not contain everything that they wanted. But health care reform was also supposed to be a major landmark on the road towards the transformation of national politics. And it was an important part of Obama's effort to reinvigorate what he called a cynical public. By this standard, Obama's accomplishments deserve, in fact, lower marks. And one wonders why a presidential aspirant would combine such antithetical ideals. But Obama's attempt to synthesize pragmatism with a visionary rhetoric is actually not without precedent in American history. During the progressive era of American politics, reformers called upon their fellow citizens to substitute pragmatic and scientific expertise for the traditional features of American government, such as rights and the rule of law. And at the same time, the president framed the progressives framed their argument in nearly religious tones. For instance, one of the leading public intellectuals who I'll use to compare Obama, Herbert Crowley, outlined the mission of progressive reformers in the following way. Like all sacred causes, it must be propagated by the word and by the right of the word, which is the sword. And while I don't know what that means, it has this sort of inspirational religious tone. Now, despite its many intellectual and political leaders, the progressive movement never succeeded in garnering sufficient support among the general public to effectively change the course of American politics. And I believe the reason for the failure of the progressive movement rests in the political inadequacy of these fundamental premises and the impossible synthesis of the two. And insofar as Obama's intellectual makeup borrows from the strands of progressive thought, his political future may take the same course. In an early speech during the campaign in which Obama outlined his distinctive claim for the presidential nominee, he argued in the following terms. He says, I remember when I first ran for the state senate, I would go door to door, and people would say, look, you have a fancy law degree, you teach at a fine law school, you've done fine work, you've got a beautiful family, why would you want to go into something dirty and nasty like politics? And Obama would respond, in response to this, and the question is understandable, and it bears on today, because even those of us who are involved, even those of us who are active in the political process and in civic life, there are times when all of us feel discouraged sometimes, when we get cynical about the prospect for politics, because it seems as if sometimes politics is treated as a business and not as a mission, and that power is always trumping principle, and that we have leaders that are sometimes long on rhetoric, but short on substance, and so we get discouraged. Now, there's nothing unique about a presidential candidate who professes to have the cure for the electoral blues, as the quote above illustrates. But as the quote above illustrates, the stakes are much higher for Obama, who claims to be engaged in a program of restoring the whole body politic rather than the modest goal of waging a programmatic campaign that merely aims to heal particular wounds or diseases. Moreover, Obama's proposals for change are directly linked to fostering a new tone of politics. He says the problem is the smallness of our politics, focusing on ideologies rather than visions. The right policy changes then will flow from the right changes in the manner in which we approach politics as a whole. Obama believes that the cynicism that ails our electorate today is the result of the failure on the part of government to keep up with the evolutionary development of society. Hence, the real problem is not the failure of any particular political officer, but the failure of the nation as a whole to revisit its most fundamental ideas and adapt democratic institutions to meet the challenges of a new century. Like Obama, the progressives of the early 20th century believed that a majority of American citizens had come to disdain politics because the institutions of government had failed to keep pace with the dramatic economic and social changes of the Industrial Revolution. It was therefore a momentous juncture in American political life that for thinkers like Herbert Croly required a new direction for the orientation of the nation. As Croly argued, the transformation of the old sense of a glorious national destiny into the sense of a serious national purpose will inevitably tend to make the popular realization of the promise of American life more explicit and serious. As long as Americans believed they were able to fulfill a noble national promise merely by virtue of maintaining intact a set of political institutions by the pursuit of private ends, their allegiance to their national fulfillment remained more of a matter of words than of deeds. But now they are being aroused from their patriotic slumber. The effect is inevitably to disentangle the national ideas and to give it more dignity. According to Croly, the American founding had wrongly been conceived by many conservatives of the 20th century as something like a social contract. Rather, its real meaning consisted in the promise of a better life. We can only realize the original promise of American life by rejecting the traditional strains on government imposed by the original Constitution. And I think what's novel about the contribution of the progressives was to reframe the meaning of the American founding. Whereas Croly complains that most Americans have what he calls optimism, fatalism, and conservatism, an attachment to the original social contract. What we need to understand about the founding was, according to Croly, that it was an experiment that put into practice modern liberalism and an experiment in a new form of government. Thus, what Americans ought to admire about the founding is not the ideas that were fixed into law, but rather the founders' courage demonstrated in their constant willingness to be innovators. To emulate them, we too must be open to ongoing reform. I believe Obama's approach to the challenges of reform today is actually quite similar to that of Croly and other progressives. Obama wants to inspire among the people a desire for change as an end in itself. And he speaks highly of the courage of the American founders exhibited in their time when they too pushed for change. Thus, the trademark of Obama's campaign has been the simple use of the phrase change. But in what does this change consist? That is always unclear. But to get an understanding of why change is central, we need to look at Obama's understanding of the fundamental features of American politics. In a chapter on the Constitution in his book, The Audacity of Hope, Obama makes his case for the living Constitution thesis, while at the same time praising the original Constitution for its enduring wisdom and virtues. In fact, the essential features of the Constitution, according to Obama, constitute something that all conservatives and liberals can agree on. The founders provided what he calls a blueprint. As Obama explains, as with our understanding of the Declaration, we debate the details of the constitutional construction. We may object to Congress's abuse of expanded Commerce Clause powers to the detriment of the states or to the erosion of Congress's power to declare war, but we are confident in the fundamental soundness of the founders' blueprint and the Democratic House that resulted. Conservative or liberal, we are all constitutionalists. Indeed, at the opening of the chapter, he decries the fact that most legislators spend more time arguing what the law is rather than what it ought to be. Faced with these manifold interpretations of fundamental and statutory law when he was in Congress, Obama reports that he went back to the Constitution at the beginning of his first term as a U.S. senator. He describes what a great boon it is in America that we can so easily return to our first principles because they are so accessible. In fact, he even confesses to the reader a certain sympathy for what he calls Justice Scalia's strict constructionist interpretation of the Constitution. He says, I understand the strict constructionist reverence for the founders. Indeed, I've often wondered if the founders themselves recognized at the time of their accomplishment. I appreciate the temptation on the part of Justice Scalia and others to assume our democracy should be treated as fixed and unwavering. The fundamentalist faith that if the original understanding of the Constitution is followed without question or deviation, and if we remain true to the rules that the founders set forth as they intended, then we will be rewarded and all good will follow. Obama's account of strict constructionism reminds me of what Crowley calls our strange mixture of optimism, fatalism, and conservatism, which Crowley decries in The Promise of American Life, and all of which Obama here seemingly endorses until strikingly a few lines later Obama states, "Ultimately, though, I have to side with Justice Breyer's view of the Constitution," surprise, surprise, "that it is not a static but rather a living document and must be read in the context of an ever-changing world." But even here, Obama frames his endorsement of the living Constitution thesis in conservative terms. In siding with Breyer's living Constitution thesis against what Obama calls the simple-mindedness of the strict constructionists, he also says that he cannot side with the apostates and relativists who conclude that there were differences over original intent among the founders themselves, therefore we are free to make up whatever constitutional meaning we want. Comparing himself to a creation scientist, he says, "I prefer to assume that someone's at the wheel." Having then set up the argument between strict construction on the one side, relativism on the other, Obama makes the case for the pragmatic middle. And the pragmatic middle turns out to be the living Constitution thesis. "The answer I settle on," says Obama, "requires a shift in metaphors, one that sees our democracy not as a house to be built, but a conversation to be had. According to this conception, the genius of Madison's design is not that it provides us a fixed blueprint for action." A few lines later, he had called the founders' work great because it provided us a blueprint. Now he says that Madison's design was not a blueprint, but fidelity to those rules will not guarantee a just society or assure agreement on what is right. Hence, the function of the Constitution, according to Obama, is to force us into a conversation, what he calls a deliberative democracy, in which all citizens are required to engage in a process of testing their ideas against external reality. All right, so why is it assert that it was only a blueprint and then deny that it is, in fact, a blueprint? Towards the end of his treatment of the Constitution and the Audacity of Hope, Obama reveals the real meaning of his argument. "The founders," he says, "may have trusted in God, but true to the Enlightenment spirit, they also trusted in the minds and senses that God had given them. They were suspicious of abstraction and liked asking questions, which is why at every turn in our early history, theory yielded to fact and necessity. As a philosophical movement, pragmatism means the rejection of the kind of abstraction that characterizes the Enlightenment thought in favor of testing theories according to experience of fact and necessity." Obama, consciously or not, praises the Enlightenment of the founders for rejecting the doctrines of the Enlightenment. The conversation Obama must have in mind constitutes more than simply the right to freely determine policy goals under the Constitution's prescribed rules of procedure. It means finding a substitute in pragmatism, or as what Crowley calls experimentation, for the narrow strictures of fundamental law. Now, rather than speak of social contracts or obligations, Obama speaks rather in terms of promises. In fact, his famous speech, given at the Democratic primary, was entitled "The American Promise." And for Obama, the term promise is an attempt to restructure the meaning of political life, cultivating a common bond and sense of purpose, whereas abstract convictions like rights and the rule of law sow seeds of faction and discontent. To realize a promise, we must abandon more than just our individual habits. We need to surrender any claim that one set of ideas is absolutely right. Well, the problem with realizing something as vague as a promise is that it's hard to measure any act of reform, because every reform is an incremental step towards the next act of reform. So that the problem then is that instead of being able to measure reform by a certain set of principles or goals, one has to speak like the progressives in terms of visionary ends that can't be articulated. In fact, in order to truly be pragmatic, one has to say that there is a final end, but not define what that end is. So the progressives would say progressives like Crowley are reduced to saying in the conclusion of their book that the ultimate end or purpose is summarized in something like this: the laborious work of the individual and social fulfillment may eventually be transfigured by an outburst of social enthusiasm, one which is not the expression of a mood, but which is substantially the finer flower of an achieved and experienced living tradition. And another great line is, the common citizen can become something of a saint and something of a hero, not by growing in heroic proportions in his own person, but by the sincere, enthusiastic imitation of heroes and saints. And whether or not he will ever come to such imitation will depend upon the ability of his exceptional fellow countrymen to offer him acceptable examples of heroism and saintliness. So that the same visionary rhetoric that characterizes the progressive era, I think, is also the sort of messianic and millennial rhetoric that characterizes the Obama administration. If Obama's aim is to cure the disease of cynicism, the problem is that I think he's also sown the seeds for the disdain of politics by citizens disappointed who leverage all of their finest hopes in him alone. And thus, I think there might be a positive benefit also to the failure of the Obama administration, and that is a reappreciation of the American founding principles, not on their smallness, but on their precision about understanding our nature and the limits of political life.